We've discussed a lot in the last few weeks on IVF, on reproduction technologies. Tonight we're going to do something a little bit different on the lines of IVF. We're going to look at, in the beginning, some, we'll call it things which are today's science fiction and tomorrow's reality. A couple of things which we may have mentioned briefly, and just excuse me if some of them sound like really funny and really like horrible, but these are things which, anything which I'm saying here, I've actually seen sources for in rabbinic writings where they're actually, where they're addressed. So there have been, these things have been addressed, obviously in a very theoretical way, but they definitely can become reality. Last week we concluded by talking about a very interesting one, and that was where we, after speaking about transplantation of reproductive organs, we spoke about gene transplantation, the possibility where they could actually place a particular gene into the sperm of a man, into the egg of a woman, and they will have children of a particular type. They know the gene marking, they know they're able to transplant. Yeah, it's not transplantation of a entire fertilized egg. As transplantation, it's just, shouldn't even be called transplantation, just placing within them that particular gene. And we asked the question, we discussed whether the child born after that has got any connection to the donor of such genes. Maybe, you know, is that person, you know, well, the blonde hair definitely comes from somewhere else, you know, the blue eyes come from somewhere else. Should there be some kind of connection, should there be some kind of difference, also halachically, when it comes to the person's Judaism, when it comes to a lot of the different things like that. We discussed, as mentioned, a donation of reproductive organs, and we asked the question whether one would say that the child born has any connection to the donor. That was one which is, that is something which is definitely discussed more than the first one, because it's something which is already quite real with regards to certain things. We concluded by saying that in that particular case, it may make a difference, according to particular certain opinions, if the sperm or the egg used for a pregnancy were taken very soon after the organ was donated, or a long time afterwards. Even though that medically there is evidence of there being a connection even a long time afterwards, so that medically there have been cases where something was transplanted, a reproductive organ, and particularly came from a man in that particular case, and he had, certain genetic problems, genetic diseases, which the donor had, showed up in these children who were born a few years later. But nevertheless, usually what I've seen, the rabbis write, is that the only time to really perhaps make a question at all is if it happened right after, if the child was born from that sperm and egg very soon after the donation, because then maybe it didn't change from the original person or something like that. Today the question is a little bit different for you, a different one, and this is something which is already discussed by some rabbis. I've seen it mentioned in a couple of sources. We'll discuss soon the topic of what's called xenografts, however you want to call it, and xenotransplantation, where they use things which are organs and different things which come from animals for human beings. Now, as a present, I don't use full organs, but definitely skin has been taken from pigs, for example, for skin grafts. Heart valves have definitely been taken from different animals for pigs, and baboons and that for human beings. We'll talk about that soon, because we'll lead into that. But what would be, in carrying on with our topic, what would be if it will one day become possible to implant a human fetus into the body of an animal, for the animal to give birth? So someone is not able to find a surrogate mother, a human mother, and they come and they want to, you know, these things are absolute science fiction today, but you never ever know. You never know where things could lead to, and the rabbis mentioned this. So you're talking about let's put it this way, you have again, human, they went along with the normal process of IVF. So they took out the egg from the mother and sperm from the father, put it together, and now they need someone to carry it. There's no someone, but there's something. There's an animal. In fact, the animal, and the animal will give birth. The animal will carry it through gestational period, and that animal will be the mother or the incubator of the child or the creature which will be born. I think that in this particular case, and this is the way that they address it, it's not a question of who's the Jewish or halachic mother. It's really a question of, is this creature born human or not? Is it going to be a human being or is it not going to be? When we spoke about a surrogate, so then we said surrogate mother. So then the question is, how is Jewish identity, how does halacha look at who is the mother of the child? Is it the egg donor or is it the one who gives birth to the kid who gives birth? But over here, the nature of the question is very different. It definitely is. Is this child considered to be a human being? And we have no idea how such a child, how it would come out. We don't know what would be, but it's definitely a scary kind of situation, a meshuggah situation. But you know what? Years ago, the truth is that years ago, a lot of things that we have today were also undreamt of and were also considered to be absolutely meshuggah. Imagine cloning, and if you would have gone to someone years ago and told them, let's say 100 years ago, and told them, do you know that one day there's going to be a situation where people who want to have children, but the mother doesn't want to go through the bother, and they'll hire someone else, they'll pay someone else, and the other person will just have the children for them. Their children, the other person will be the human incubator for them. You know, so as crazy as it was, and today it's a very, very big reality, so this question also, I mean, it's absolutely crazy, but people are crazy, and people can come up with the most meshuggah things. That's what we spoke about. That's what we spoke about. Right? We spoke about that idea, when exactly conception starts, how it affects this whole discussion. On this one, the Talmud actually seems to give very clear rulings. The Talmud addresses the issue. Okay? We mentioned the very first class about how artificial insemination is addressed by the Talmud. And this one, to the Talmud, addresses the issue. The Talmud discusses at length a case of a woman who gave birth to something that, as the Talmud said, resembles a snake or a locust, a grasshopper. A woman gave birth to such a thing. The context of the Talmudic discussion, and why it was actually practical for the Talmud, and in ways is still practical in certain halachic things, is that the creature born, the way the Talmud was discussing it, was not alive. Talking about the woman gave birth, whatever she miscarried, some pieces, something which looked like a locust, looked like a snake, did not look like a human being, looked like an animal. But it makes a difference in the Talmud, because a dead human being carries tumor. A dead human being defiles, whereas a dead animal does not. So therefore, for example, if there's a dead human being or parts of a human being in a room, in a building, and another person goes into that room or into the building, if you're under the same roof, those are the laws of tumor. The tumor is conveyed from one person, from the body, to the person. That is only applicable today for a kohen. A kohen today still also has to keep away from that, but it was at the time of the temple, it was definitely applicable for all Jews, because in order to go up three times a year, the Jews had to be totally pure, and therefore they sprinkled themselves with the ashes of the red cow, the red heifer, and the purpose of that was to purify them from this status. So the Talmud's question is a real question. So the Talmud's question is this considered to be a human or is it not human? Remember, it came from a human being, but it looks like a grasshopper, looks like a snake, and this is brought in the codes as well in halacha. It's clear from the Talmud that the identity of or member of a particular species is determined not by distinguishing physical character traits or how the species, what it looks like, but on the one who gives birth to it. That's very clear from the Talmud over there, that such a thing, such a piece, such a locust or a snake or these kind of things which came out of a woman, okay, and they're talking about it looked like that. The Talmud's words are kemin chagav, it looked like a species, it looked like something of, like, obviously not an actual locust, right? Not actual snake, but doesn't look like a human being. The Talmud says it conveys tumor, it conveys impurity like a human being because a human being gave birth to it. The Talmud, now our question was the opposite way around. Our question is about a human being giving birth, an animal giving birth to a human being. And that too the Talmud addresses. Head on. Exactly that case the Talmud talks about. The Talmud says that the way that, first way, let's first say, the way that the Talmud approaches, or rather broaches the topic, how the Talmud speaks about it, is in a most interesting way, most interesting context. Talmud says like this, even though that the rules for which animals are kosher and which animals are not kosher are determined by the signs that the Torah gives us, says that the animal, if an animal chooses cud and has split hooves, then the animal is kosher. If a fish has fins and scales, then the fish is kosher. Says the Talmud, there's another requirement, there's another rule that overrides the signs. There's a rule which is more important than those signs. And what is that rule? That the animal has to come from a kosher animal. Okay? So says the Talmud, and that is a vital requirement, meaning the mother cow, whatever it is, which gave birth to this particular cow, also has to have been kosher. Therefore, says the Talmud, you can have an animal which will have split hooves. Talmud talks about this. Talmud says, you can have an animal which will have split hooves and will chew its cud, and nevertheless is not kosher. Talmud says, hok heitzad, how is that possible? Split hooves, chewing the cud. Talmud says, if a horse, a donkey, somehow gave birth to an animal, gave birth to something which had split hooves and chews its cud, says the Talmud, it's nevertheless not kosher, because the rule is that habo min hatome tome, that which comes from an unclean animal will always be unclean. Habo min hator, and that which comes from a clean animal will be clean. And therefore, the other way around as well. If you can have an animal which does not have split hooves, does not chew its cud, but can be kosher. How is that? That can be if you have a kosher animal, a cow, which gave birth to something which looks like a horse. It will also be kosher. There will be problems, rabbinic problems of marit ayin. Marit ayin are what it looks like. You know, people see someone eating a horse. You know, it doesn't look so good. Right, you don't see the mother. Exactly, that's exactly the case. But really, technically speaking, such an animal is kosher because habo min hator, that which comes from a pure animal, will always be pure, and that cannot change. Here the Gemara asks the following question. Now you see how it falls into context. The Talmud says like this. What if you have a human-like creature born to an animal? The Talmud talks about such a thing. If you have a human-like creature born to an animal, which is a kosher animal, you have a cow which gave birth to something which looks like a human being. The Talmud's question, and this is where we understand the Talmud's view on it, the Talmud's question is, can we slaughter it to eat? Can we slaughter such a thing to use it as food? Okay? We won't give the Talmud's answer. It's a bit of a complex one in that particular situation, right? But Talmud's question is, since it does not possess the hoof, doesn't chew its cud, like its mother does, should we say that it's not kosher? Or should we say that the rule is that anything which comes from a pure animal is pure, and therefore we can slaughter? So from there we understand very clearly, without going into the Talmud's answer, from the Talmud's question, we already understand that the Talmud does not regard a creature of such a nature, or even to be even partially human whatsoever. Otherwise, the Talmud wouldn't ask such a question, can we slaughter it for food? Obviously, if a cow gives birth, an animal gives birth to a human being, the Talmud's opinion, the way the Talmud looks at it, is that it's not kosher. Sorry, not that it's not kosher, that's the discussion. That it is not human, and therefore, the question comes up, can we slaughter it, can we not? We're saying this today in a theoretical way, but, you know, in a few years' time, might think like it's an absolute joke to even say that. What do you mean? Human beings, it looks like a human being and acts like a human being. Yeah?
This is the frightening thing about it, the fact that there it is in the Talmud.
The Talmud definitely talks about that situation.
So much has been, you know, it's talked about it and relates to now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this has been talking about it. You know, in the future, you know, it can be, why is it right. there? Why is the reason there? It could be there because we would be facing
right. No, the more you learn, I'm sure as we've seen, the more we learn, the more we appreciate that really the Torah and the Gemara, the Talmud, is a book of principles. That's what it is. It's a general book of principles for us to derive laws. And the challenge is today, well, not for us, it's the challenge for the rabbis who are able to do that, to correctly derive the laws from the Talmud. And of course, you always, and that's what we go through all the time. One rabbi says this is comparable to such a situation. Another rabbi says, well, it's not comparable at all, because over there that's very different. we'll see soon, and then we'll mention another couple of them. No. But they're definitely, you see, the Talmud addresses the issue of a human, of a cow giving birth to a to a, to a human being. Talks about such a thing. It's in a different context, right? With these things,
but so therefore, isn't it the responsibility of the rabbis today to actually be standing up and educating people that we shouldn't be going down these roads?
Right. So, wait a second. Right.
Because once the
slippery slope,
born,
right?
Once the child's been born inside the cow, and it's front page of all the newspaper, and then somebody else wants their child born inside. All of a sudden, within a very short period of time, it becomes acceptable. And
well, the truth is, the truth is that. In many of these things, how should I put it, the scientists are ahead of the rabbis. What it means is that they are actually coming up with things, and the rabbis have to deal with, well, how, what are we going to do, how should we do? And it makes sense, because they're in the field, they know what's possible and what's not possible. A rabbi doesn't know if it's possible. You know, the scientists know that part of the thing is that there's a difference, that the womb of a cow is different, the uterus of a cow is different to that of a human, which a human fetus needs. And therefore, but we can give these certain injections which can make it that it's going to hold it and not reject it and things like that. These are things which the rabbis don't have a clue about, right? So therefore, they can't preempt, but they can be quick when these things come out to say, well, you know, this thing is out. And that's why when it comes to surrogacy, for example, we mentioned different views, and we mentioned that there are those who rarely, but there are those who would allow it with surrogacy with a Jewish mother, right? With non-Jewish mother, definitely very, very rare that you find rabbis who allow it. But even those who say so, who do allow it, the egg was given to egg and sperm of a couple was given to a mother to carry, a surrogate mother to carry. Another woman is going to. Well, they allow. That's a definitely Jewish, single, not related. All those, with all those details. That's what we spoke about. But even that, even those rabbis who allow it, it has to be real exceptional, and they don't. And they definitely don't make a rule of it. It is the exception rather than the rule. Totally, totally exception rather than the rule. And you won't actually find a rabbi who will be bold enough to say, I allow it. You don't find at all because, I mean, you're allowing this, you know, where this, which, where such things lead to. And it's a, and that is like real exceptional kind of thing.
Can I just ask, if we're talking hypothetical, if there was...
Well, that's what we're talking about tonight. And until we're going to talk, we will talk about something real as well.
But if there was a machine...
Very, very good, but we're going to get to that. Exactly, that's one of the things we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about that. It's exactly what we're going to talk about. Okay, but before we get to that, now that we were just talking about this rule, that something which comes from a pure animal is pure, something which comes from non-pure animal is non-pure, something which I mentioned in the email. But there's a very interesting question like this. This is also science fiction, but this is becoming reality much, much quicker than what we discussed before. And that is... Let's say, you know, the requirements for a kosher animal is that the animal has split hooves and that it chews a cud, and that for a fish, that it has fins and scales. Let's say that the scientists find the DNA markers to be able to tell exactly what causes split hooves, what causes the animal to chew its cud, what causes fins, and what causes scales. And the scientists go and they take an animal today, and they go take a pig, which only has split hooves, and they genetically give a few injections to the pig, and they cause the pig to start chewing its cud. Or they take a prawn, they take a lobster, they take something something from the sea, and they give it injections that it should start having fins and scales. Now this is really, really not far off at all. If it's definitely done to a certain degree with certain things, right? Maybe even with fins and scales. Could definitely, definitely be. The way that they usually do it is not that they'll be able to inject it, that it should actually start growing, that kind of thing, but rather they could inject the mother in such a way that the mother, the father, whatever it is, that they could give birth to such a creature. But anyway, this, the question is the same. You have a pig which chews its cud, has split hooves, chews its cud, is it kosher or not? You have a prawn, you have a lobster, crab, these things which have fins, which have scales. Are they kosher or are they not kosher? seemingly, if there are requirements for a kosher fish, a kosher animal, they have fins and scales, chew the cud, and have split hooves. So the fish, the animal, the pig has it, the prawn has it. Should it be kosher? Should it not be kosher? And this is something which the rabbis do address. Already, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach passed away 15 years ago. We'll mention him again later on. He was a great halachic opinion in these things. In just two lines, he said that in almost any situation, and he didn't really explain, but he said in almost any situation, it will definitely not be kosher. What's the reason? The reason is, as we said before, in addition to the animal having to chew its cud and have split hooves, it also has to come from a kosher animal. A kosher animal means a real kosher animal, not one which was made kosher. Like even if it was made kosher, but its mother wasn't a kosher animal. And therefore, there's no way in that kind of thinking that you could possibly have a kosher pig. Why? Because if either you're making that pig now chew its cud, but still the pig wasn't born from a kosher pig, or even if they do it in such a way where they inject these genes or whatever it is into these DNA markers, whatever it is, into the pig, the mother, and the mother gives birth to such a child, but the mother wasn't kosher, it doesn't make a difference, and therefore it would never work. Do you know that grafting? Halachically, I don't want to get onto this, but halachically, the complications of genetics, genetic mutations, and genetic engineering, when it comes to fruit and things like that, is much more complicated than when it comes to animals. Halachically, why? For example, an estrog has to be a real estrog; can't be a graft with a lemon. Now, let's say they want to make a perfect estrog. Everyone goes crazy and they spend so much money on the estrog. Imagine you can have an estrog this size, beautiful estrog, which they'll make it, the pitum won't come off. They'll make it, and this is already, this genetic engineering is already old, you know. And they'll be able to have it that the skin, it will have the perfect bumps, and it will have the perfect, like the middle piece, and it will look like the perfect estrog. Question is that allowed, is it not allowed? But you're using different elements of a lemon, the smoothness in certain parts you're getting from a lemon, the cleanliness you're getting from an orange, let's say. Is that allowed? Is that called grafting halakhically or not? That's definitely a topic. There's definitely a discussion in the field of genetics. But over here, with regards to this, anything born of a non-kosher animal will remain non-kosher.
So therefore, not grandchild.
Never. However, this can change if we have a situation. Let's say this is where the question could come in. Let's say that they take the eggs and the sperm from the mother pig, from the mother and from the father pig, and they place it in an incubator, and they leave it there in the incubator so that the incubator gives birth to it. Then comes the question: well, the rule is habo mina tome, that which comes out of that which is tome, which is unclean, remains tome, remains unclean. That which comes from something which is pure remains pure. The question over here is, well, the animal didn't really come out of the unclean animal. It didn't come out of the pig. It came out of the incubator. So maybe then it should be kosher because they managed to inject it, whatever it is, the sperm, the egg, now in the fertilization stage, they managed to put it together with that there and put in fins and scales or chewing the cud and having split hooves. Would it be kosher or not? Or perhaps we'll say, well, it originated really from an unclean animal, and that's what the Talmud means. And that needs clarification. Exactly. What does the Talmud mean when it says that which comes from something which is pure is pure, which comes from impure? Is it meaning the birth? That seems to be the implication. Talmud's examples are that you didn't see the birth. It seems to be talking about the birth. But maybe it also depends on not something, a stage prior to the birth. I think actually, I didn't see this, that actually it would depend on something, a stage even before birth. Why is that? Because with fish, the fish don't actually give birth. Fish have eggs. And nevertheless, the rule is, the Talmud doesn't say it in the same context, it doesn't say it in the same way, but the Talmud does say, but Halacha says that if you want to know which eggs are kosher, which eggs are not kosher, so Halacha says, eggs which come from a clean fish are clean, eggs which come from unclean fish are unclean. seems to imply, caviar and all this kind of halakha gives signs to know with what came from where, if it's black and if the eggs look like this and different things. But at any rate, it seems to be that even from the stage of the eggs, already we have this law of things which are pure have to have come from a pure source, and things which are impure have to have come from an impure source. But at any rate, that could definitely be argued with.
If they took this DNA markers or whatever, and I don't know whether it would be, and it was economically a sensible thing, because it would all come down to economics. If it came down that they could inject the DNA markers of a pig into a cow, so the cow would produce baby calves that had the taste and cookability and everything else of pork that people wanted, right? And it meant that the cow was much easier to breed, let's say. Would that animal that would look like a mini cow that would cook and taste and eat like a pig?
It looks like a cow and it was given birth from a cow?
But it's really pork.
Right? But it's a cow.
It's got its DNA.
But it's a cow which gave birth to it. So then, I think that it has a lot, that question has a lot to do with the question of genetic transplantation. Like we spoke about it in human beings. Is there a connection to the donor, where it came from or not? Same thing would apply here. Do we say that there's a connection or not? Halacha does talk about cases in kashrus. Let's say that you have a bunch of sheep in a pen, and over there you have they're all female sheep, and then you have a male pig, and the sheep start having children, right? Do we have to be concerned? Well, some of the seed comes from pigs and things like that. Anyway, with regards to fish, just on this discussion, there's a different reason why fish would never ever be made kosher. Certain fish would never be made kosher, and therefore we don't even have to get to this rule of coming from a pure source. Meaning to say, some fish like prawns, squid, lobster, these kind of things, would never ever be made kosher, even if they had fins and scales, and even if the fins and scales were natural on them. Why is that? Why is that? Why is that? Exactly. The rules of fins and scales, a bit of a misconception, don't apply to all sea creatures. It only applies to fish. Other sea creatures, even if they would have fins, a fish means a fish, and as the Rambam Maimonides says, a fish means something which resembles a fish, not like, the Rambam says, not like a frog, and not like a, what he calls the sea dog, which is probably referring to an otter or a seal, something like that. It's those kind of things. It doesn't look like a fish. A fish means a fish. It doesn't mean a crab or something like that. So those things are prohibited anyway, because the Torah says that all creepy things, shoots and hamayim, things which are shrots and things which are creepy, these creepy things are anyway osur, it doesn't matter what. The fins and scales are only for a fish. So therefore, crab, no matter how technology will change, crab, prawns, lobster, these things, will never ever be made kosher. There's no way out. You know, it says with regards to kashrus, the Gemara says that a person, when it comes to things like stealing and killing, the Gemara says a person should never say that, you know, I wish I could kill, just that what can I do that God says I'm not allowed. Because that's disgusting. A person should never ever have such a feeling, and if you have such a feeling, then you're really sick. But the Gemara says a person should say that, oh, I wish I can eat that. You know, I wish I could eat that cheeseburger, but what can I do that my Father in heaven decreed that I cannot have it? You know, it's a bit of a different approach. There's some things, you know, like prawns and that, I don't know. That's just, I think it's difficult to say, I wish I could have that. Okay, now, talking about gestation in an artificial way gives rise to another science fiction question. And again, it's only a science fiction question for today, but tomorrow could very well be reality. And there's something which we did mention before, discussed in rabbinic writings of rabbis today as well, concerning a fetus which was incubated for its full gestation in an artificial incubator. So then it didn't actually have exactly what you mentioned before. Does such a child have a genetic mother and father? To the mother and the father, which really, the child will look like the mother and father, makes sense. The sperm and the egg come from two live human beings. Is there considered to be a genetic connection between them? Here too, the question definitely extends beyond who is the mother, which is more of a question for those, obviously, who say that motherhood is defined by the egg donor, by the one who gives the egg. Here the question is definitely, well, over here, the question over here is such a child even considered to be a human being? Can it be considered a human being? And remember, what are you talking about over here? You're talking about a child which looks like any other child, right? So it's very hard to say, well, not human being. But we come to the question, and this is what we've been seeing the whole time, what we've taken for granted for all the generations, you know, human being, a human gives birth to a human, animal gives birth to an animal. The question is, what makes a person a human being? You know, throughout the generations, there have been many human animals, right? But what makes a person into a human being? It seems to be that a human being is defined by the fact that the human being comes about through a mother. A mother gives birth to their child. And that is what's considered to be a human being. And in fact, in the Talmud, we find in many places that the words Yiloid Isha, the one born from a woman, is a synonym, or is the way the Talmud describes a human being. For example, there's a beautiful narrative in the Talmud of the time when Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, went up to heaven to go get the Torah. And it talks about over there a whole argument which ensued between Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, and the Malachim, the angels in heaven. Moshe comes up over there, and the angels say to God, "Hey, Ma liloid isho ze beinenu? What is this one born of a woman doing here?" Right? They don't mean born of a woman. They mean, what is the human being doing here in heaven? Right? And then they have a whole discussion, and God says, he says that he's come to get the Torah, and then the Malachim are all angry. Give us the Torah. Leave your glory in heaven. Why are you giving it to these liloid isha, to this one born of a human? You know, for the angels, it seems to be like a bit of a derogatory thing. You know, liloid isha, the one born from a woman that had to go through a gestation. So the Talmud seems to make birth by a human mother a vital requirement to being a human being. Definitely seems to be that way. The question here really is whether such a child is no less than, let's say, the golem of Prague, created by the Maharal of Prague, who created it and using Kabbalistic formulas and using different things, or perhaps an angel. Yeah, is it any different to an angel? For which one definitely cannot be given the death sentence for killing, because the law, because a person would get a death sentence for killing a human being, not for killing the golem, and not for killing an angel. Yeah. Okay, that's a very interesting topic for Shia. And there's been a lot of books written on the topic of the golem, where definitely the golem appears in many halachic texts as well, right? As rabbis who write about the evidence of it, write about it they write about what about this golem, for example. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, the golem which was created, this was by the Chacham Tzvi, he writes a couple of hundred years ago, he says, what would be the law about the golem which was created by Rabbi Lovi of Prague, Maharal of Prague, would such a creature count for a minion or not? That was his question, whatever, and his whole discussion of it. So there are definitely sources, and most rabbinic sources definitely have it clear that it's not mythology at all. It was a real thing. It was a threat to the Jewish people, and that's why it was brought in many rabbis bring it in many different books.
Or if Eliyahu Hanavi appears for some kind of purpose here on earth, he's also like not a human being.
Well, he's not right. Well, if he comes here,
he appears and then he goes.
The golem definitely lived as a Jew. We know something that we know about him. He practiced as a Jew. He lived as a Jew.
We're talking about the golem
of Prague, that particular one. However, the Talmud tells many stories about the Amoraim, the men in the Talmud, who used to sit on a Friday afternoon, and for a bit of fun, they used to create men. They used to create things to eat. And the Talmud talks that it says that Rabbah once made a man. He created a man, and then the rabbis didn't like the man, and they told him to go back to from where he came. You know, it's definitely the Talmud talks about these things. You know, Okay? No, you know what happened?
I don't need him anymore.
It's a very good story with the golem. I don't want to go off topic. The golem really is a good topic to discuss. It's a fascinating, fascinating topic. In Prague today, there's a statue of a golem.
Yeah.
But I haven't been there. I've just seen a picture of it. You talk about the golem, first of all. The golem, we know some things about him. He practiced as a Jew. But what I mean practice, he wore a yarmulke and he looked like any other Jew. He didn't daven, didn't do anything like that. He wasn't able to talk. Golem wasn't able to talk because only Hashem can make a talking human being. That's what seems to be implied. Only Hashem can make something which will actually talk.
So if this thing, you've got to put this in here quickly.
Right.
If this thing that comes out of the
incubator. The incubator, that's exactly what I'm going to say. Right. Oh, if it can talk, I don't know. And so the question is it, well, we'll be able to talk. Good question. So then it's not exactly like a golem, maybe. Good one, I didn't think of that. The rabbi who wrote about this concludes that concerning this issue, a child who comes about from an incubator, he says that, well, we'll have to be nice to him and consider him to be a human being and everything like that, right? But halachically, if someone were to kill him, the person would not be able to get the death penalty whatsoever as of killing a human being. You can't. Anyway, it would be a suffix, it would be a doubt. You can't kill someone if it's a doubt that the person is a... If you would count for me, that depends. Would such a person be Jewish? Right? That is, the question of being Jewish is, does that period of him... What causes one's Judaism? Right? According to those who said that Judaism can be caused... According to those who said that Judaism is all dependent on delivery of the child, so then this child definitely not Jewish. The question arises, according to those opinion, the minority opinion, which says that one has to take into consideration the egg donor as well. If the egg donor, so then the egg donor was Jewish. But over here, maybe a little bit different. Why? Because you got this, it wasn't, the egg, those who said that if the egg donor is Jewish, then the child is Jewish, that meant that it was still came about as from a human being in a natural way. But over here, maybe very, very different in this context. So too, if you call such a person not a human being, there would be a, as he writes, the rabbi who addresses this, he says, he had a lot of time on his hands to write about these things, but he says that in such a situation, you would not be allowed to desecrate Shabbos to save such a person. Because you can only save a person who's pekuach nefesh, which means to save a life, is the life of a human being. Unfortunately, you can't desecrate Shabbos to save a dog or a cat. You can't do that, as long as much as you love it. Same thing over here. This person, if there's a question if he's a human being, okay, if we know for sure there's not a human being, and he seems to say such a thing is not a human being, so that then you cannot desecrate Shabbos either. Right. Doesn't make a difference whatsoever, but they were born from a mother. It doesn't matter what it is.
If does the fetus need to be in the mother?
Well, as long
as you have a machine and you can see the mother's going to have a miscarriage, immediate cesarean, take the fetus that's tiny out and put it in.
Right, but as
long
as quite simple, as long as it is medically able to survive outside of its mother, it means that it was in its mother technically enough time for it to be, for the mother to be the gestational mother, right? So if they could bring that back, so the baby only has to be for 1 week, but it's still, I think
it was
it's still...
It was in the test tube for a while, it was in the mother for 1 week.
But yeah, it's very different.
It got taken out, it's a baby.
Yeah, well, it went through a natural stage
of
a mother, right?
Okay.
Right? It's a good question.
Because they're making life viable.
He writes like this, however. He writes, it's not absolutely out of the question that such a child... But basically, what comes out of that is as follows. Who is the only human being who was not born from a mother?
Adam.
So it comes out like this. If someone had killed Adam, he actually wouldn't have been killed, right? He wouldn't have had to get the death penalty for killing him. Why not? Because Adam wasn't born from a human being, right? So it's a bit of a tricky one. What? No, that's a different discussion. He had the souls of all people, of all the Jewish people. He himself wasn't Jewish. He came from Avraham Avinu, and he came from Moshe. And yeah. He does. Now, this rabbi who addresses this topic, he writes that even though such a person or such a creature is not human, well, we can't consider them human in with regards to if someone would kill them, that they'd actually get a death penalty. But he says not totally out of the question that such a child has no lineage at all. is why, because we've discussed this before, that there's a discussion when paternity starts. When does paternity? Yes, that's exactly the case. When does paternity start? Now those who say that with maternity we've got this big problem because just fertilization of the sperm and the egg of her part doesn't mean that everything's finished, because she has another stage. The next stage, the crucial stage of giving birth to the child. When it comes to a father, when it comes to the paternal side, the father has finished his job as soon as fertilization has taken effect. What he gives into the child has already finished right over there. And therefore, there are those who say paternity starts actually. He's called the father of a child from the very, very beginning. And therefore, this rabbi says, so what's the difference? If he's called a father from the moment that it's in the test tube and they're together, who cares whether it's placed back into a human being, a mother, to give birth to, or whether it's placed in the incubator? He says it's not. He doesn't want to rule. But he says it's not totally out of the question that this non-human has no lineage whatsoever. And therefore, you can have a case of a non-human Kohen. Right? Could be a Kohen, but he's not human. Right? Because he's not human. If you kill him, there's no problem. It could still be a Kohen because he has that lineage. It's an interesting one. Need a bris. Needing a bris is a very, very interesting one. Because you bring up something that I remember, something which I saw. It says that there's a very well-known question. We have in the Talmud a couple of times where someone died and another one of the Amoraim, one of the men in the Talmud brought him back to life. There's many questions which this brings about. One of the questions is, first of all, does the man have to remarry again? Right? Yep. Usually, we discussed it once before. We discussed this in the context of a heart which stopped. If someone dies, right, the woman is allowed to remarry. Right? Why? Because death releases her, just like a get releases, death releases. So it's in this case. The man died, he comes back to life. The whole question, would he have to remarry, would he not have to remarry? And the question would be applicable, please God, when Mashiach comes, you know, dead are going to come back to life, and husband and wife are going to remarry. Okay, which husband, which wife, is also a good question. But the question is, will they need to have this, will they have to remarry, do kiddushin again, and go through the chuppah and go through the whole ceremony? There's a question like this as well. So there are many kind of these questions which come about if someone was killed and brought back, someone died and was brought back to life. Another question is like this. Is that person considered to be born again, as if they come to life again, where the rule is that if someone is born with a bris, someone is born circumcised, the moyo, or the rabbi, whoever it is, has to do hatafat dam bris, has to take just a drop of blood. So the question is, in this situation, someone who's brought back to life, is it necessary for there to be hatafat dam bris? Again, he's been circumcised because he's lived many years as a Jew, but then he died, then he came back to life, and would he need to have hatafat dam bris? I'm only mentioning that because you said about a bris. Yes. Oh, so that's the discussion. That's a real one. That's a real question today. Today people die, and they use a defibrillator. They do different things. They bring the person. The heart stop breathing. Things like that.
Right.
On a slightly different note, is something which we once discussed before. We spoke about organ donation once. Last year here in Sydney, they performed the first artificial heart implantation. In the Southern Hemisphere. I say in the Southern Hemisphere because in America they did it already, and how do I know this? I know this from the rabbis writing about it. They already did it 30 years ago. 30 years ago the rabbis were already writing about this because whatever wasn't approved to do over here, and therefore it wasn't done. But last year in June it was first done over here, and it gives rise to a number of questions. So human being with a mechanical heart, right? Obviously this is advancing, the hearts are able to work longer, and every year they get better with these kind of things, which changes the question. But some of the questions which it gives rise to is that all parts of a human being require burial upon death. Is this considered to be part of the human being? Does it require burial? Number two is any mutilation of a body is totally prohibited. In Jewish law, autopsies are totally out. Question over here is, can they mutilate the body to retrieve that artificial heart? person is dead, is it, does it warrant it or not? I mean,
is it a problem marrying an artificial mouth?
It's not a problem if it's necessary. If you have to, no, it's not. It wouldn't be a problem to bury it. Right. Right. That's what we're going to get to. And then, as we asked over here. No, we're talking about the new heart, the mechanical heart. Mechanical heart.
When someone dies, you take it out and then you put it in someone else because it's an expensive toy.
Exactly. So the question is, are they allowed to retrieve it? And first of all, does it require burial? Any part of a human being? If an organ was donated to someone, it requires burial. There is a lucky question where it should be buried. Should an organ which is donated to someone be buried with that person who it was donated to? Or with the donor. And the answer is, after all conclusions, according to everyone, it becomes part and parcel of the person who got it, the recipient, and it gets buried with them. But over here, this question is, does this require burial? Is it considered part of the person? The third question, as we asked over here, if someone were to kill another person, and this person only has a mechanical heart, would he be considered is he liable for murder? Is that considered to be killing? Or is it like just switching off a robot, switching off a machine, because the machine was keeping the person going? The answer to all these questions is quite simple. I mean, there is a lot of, we're saying it very briefly, but it's definitely straightforward. External things like a pacemaker, an artificial heart, things like that, don't become part of the person. They're external because they're not of flesh and blood. And therefore, since they're not of a person, they do not require burial with that person. Whether mutilation is allowed, or maybe not mutilation, just to, we'll use a better word, whether they're allowed to retrieve it, to go and get back that artificial heart, depends. The rabbi's right. It depends on who that heart belongs to, and whether it is, how necessary it is for them to retrieve it. Now, in most situations, it doesn't belong to the person themselves. These things are very, very expensive. It would probably belong to the hospital, and then, which means that when they put that into the person, he knew that they're placing it in him, or him or whatever it was, on condition that it will be able to be retrieved, and then thereon it would be allowed. If it belonged to him privately, and it was not immediately needed by someone else, then it's definitely a lot more tricky to justify.
Yes, that makes a difference.
As to the life of such a person, well, the truth is, it doesn't really matter what is keeping a person alive. If, as we discussed with regards to the moment of death and these issues, if they have breath in their nostrils, which the Torah describes as being alive, the person has a ruach as a wind, as breath in the nostrils, they're considered to be alive, and removal of that is tantamount to murder. Someone goes and switches off the machine, and someone goes and kills the person with such a heart, it doesn't make a difference whatsoever. There would be a difference, should be noted, in halacha, if you kill this person, and this person would not have lived more than 12 months anyway. There's a general halachic ruling. When it comes to, the person would be guilty of murder, but would not get the death penalty. The death penalty is only for someone who killed someone else, and that person would have lived more than 12 months. Someone who would not have lived 12 months would not get the death penalty for killing such a person. Although in general, this is not something which the Beis Din had to go and check into. The Sanhedrin, when they came to executing someone, they wouldn't have to go and check this guy's medical record and see would he have lived 12 months or more. Because we assume that every person will live more than 12 months unless we know otherwise. Well, in this situation, the question is, will that person actually live more than 12 months with this artificial piece in their body or not? And then would be a difference if that person who killed them would actually get a death penalty or not. Definitely, but that's a different topic.
Yeah. I know, but I was just
that's totally different topic. We did that once
yeah.
Last year. There's definitely a lot about it. Yes. We started speaking this science fiction discussion with regards talking about using animals for gestational purposes, and we just finished talking about with artificial organ donations. But let's just say that it's something a bit different. A person got a skin graft using skin from a pig, or a heart valve, or what's definitely already been experimented with, a baboon heart, or things like that. And this could definitely, and this is the way that scientists, and they're working this way because it's a severe shortage of organs, and they're looking at this is good, this would be the way. Is such a thing, let's say it comes from a pig, from a non-kosher animal, is it permitted to a Jew? And there are those who actually read, many misunderstand. The Torah said, in this was last week's parasha, the wording the Torah says regarding a non-kosher animal, the Torah says that you may not eat them and you may not touch their carcasses. Of such a, you not eat of them, or beniblachsom loisigo, and with their, on their carcasses you may not touch. Now what that means doesn't mean that you're not allowed to touch a pig. What it means is that when it comes to laws of tumah and tara, of ritual purity and impurity, then it makes a difference. And therefore, when the Jewish people were going up to Jerusalem for the festivals or a kohen, they were not allowed to touch the carcasses of non-kosher animals. And even that applied only to the flesh of the animal and not to the skin, that which was external, because the skin does not convey impurity. So the skin, if a person were to get a skin graft, something like that, would definitely not be a problem. And even if there would have been a problem with it, anyway, the rule is that pikuach nefesh, to save a person, pushes away all these mitzvahs, except for three, and this is obviously not one of them. So one would be allowed to use anything from a human being. May not be nice to think that, well, I have the heart of a the heart of a pig, right? I don't know that what that would do to a person spiritually, you know, that the, I don't know what kind of emotions and feelings that they would get. I don't know if it would make any difference, but anyway, but at any rate, pikuach nefesh would definitely allow for such a thing.
Right?
Dead animal. There were always people, especially with regards to pigs, the Shulchan Aruch talks about it, about distancing oneself from such things and not touching it, but it's not that there's actually impurity which is conveyed. Now onto something a little bit more real. Yeah, we're a bit limited on the time. We've got another few more minutes. And it's really on the lines of abortion, but very definitely very well connected, usually as a resultant of IVF, the resultant of reproduction technologies, and that is the topic of pregnancy reduction. Which what happens, what could happen very often, is that they would implant in order to have chances of maximum success, and because it's obviously it's a very expensive procedure every single time to do IVF and all these different things. What they usually, more than one fertilized egg is implanted, is placed inside, and obviously with a bit of the hope that some of them will make it, some will not make it, and that's why you have people today who have octuplets and all these fancy words. You know, you can have people with having multiple births. We already discussed that if an egg was fertilized in a laboratory for the purposes of implantation, it may be discarded if it's not needed, right? Some say don't discard it with your hand, but rather leave it, let it to die on its own. But that is because, first of all, it has not been implanted into anyone yet. And also because the purpose was to use this for IVF. Here the question is slightly different. What if all those eggs which were implanted, the fertilized eggs implanted into the woman, remain viable, they remain alive, and now she has 7 fetuses inside her, and you've got this 7 fetuses, which is definitely a huge risk to her life. It's a premature delivery and hemorrhaging and all kind of things, as well as an increased risk of miscarriage of and losing all those fetuses because there's simply not enough space and they simply cannot all survive. It's either some of them have to go, and usually what the doctors would do is something called pregnancy reduction, where they abort some of those fetuses. The question over here is first of all, is it permitted to abort some so that others have a better chance? Again, this is on the topic of abortion, but we should mention it here, ending off with IVF. Is it permitted, first of all, to abort? And secondly, how do you choose which one to abort? Now, it's quite clear that if pregnancy of any kind of pregnancy, the truth is, poses a real threat to the life of the mother, the fetus may be aborted, because that fetus halachically has the law of a roidef. Roidef means if you see someone chasing someone else to kill them, the law is, the Torah says, you have to stand up and kill that person. That is the law. Same thing over here. Now, the Gemara says very, very clearly that the fetus is chasing the mother to kill her, and the law is you have to kill the fetus to save the life of the mother. After the head of the child comes out, then there's no difference. You don't push away one life for another. However, before the child is born, so then there's it has the law of a roidef. So the same thing would apply over here. If there's danger to the life of the mother, abortion of some of them, the minimum amount which you can get by with, is allowed. Where it gets tricky, where it gets difficult, is whether it's allowed to reduce a multi-fetal pregnancy to save the lives of the remaining fetuses. So the mother's life, the mother will make it. They could say that the mother will be able to carry three, right? But they're not sure if the fetuses, if the others will make it. Let's not look at it from the angle of if one of them, if one of the fetuses are defective, if they've got some kind of abnormality, because then that really enters the discussion of abortion, if abortion is allowed at all, if one knows that there is an abnormal or a fetus which has a problem. But let's look at briefly halacha's approach to multiple gestation when they want to reduce the pregnancy, take away some of them, abort some of them in order to save the others. So some rabbis say that the same law of rodef applies over here. Each fetus is chasing the other to kill them, and therefore you can kill the one to stop the other. Other rabbis say, you can't compare the two. Why? Because if I would come and see one person chasing another person to kill them, it makes sense, kill the person who's chasing. But what if you have two people chasing each other, trying to kill them, right? Trying to kill each other. So who do you kill? Can't kill you. Who is the rodef? Who is the rodef? Rodef means chaser. Who is the one chasing? That's exactly what happens over here. When you've got a fetus, one fetus inside the mother, so the mother's not chasing anyone, but the fetus is trying to kill the mother. So then the din of a rodef. That's the law of rodef that you abort the fetus. However, if it's a different situation, that you got the two fetuses fighting with each other, both trying to kill each other, so then it's not very simple at all that there's a law of a rodef. Now, a very well-known rabbi today in Israel, who has written a lot on these issues in general, and is a well-known authority who deals with and gets these kind of questions on a daily basis, he writes that it is permitted to abort some of the fetuses in order to save the lives of another. Remember, we're talking about that the mother's life is not in danger. In order to save some of the lives of another, and he gives two halachic bases for it. The famous case of the Talmud, which definitely this is in, we spoke about this in dealing with triage. The famous case of the Talmud, if a group of people are attacked by anti-Semites, Talmud says, and anti-Semites come and they put a group of people into a room, into a city, whatever it is, and they say, hand over one of you, the particular one, they say, hand over him, or they say, anyone, there's a bit of differences, but they say, hand over one of your people, of your group, to be killed, or all of you are going down, we will kill all of you. The ruling of the Talmud is, most people rule that all must be killed and not turn over even one. However, this is what this rabbi writes, he said, there are those who say that this rule only applies, this rule that you give over everyone, sorry, that you don't hand over a single person and rather sacrifice everyone, that only applies if the chosen member, or the people in that city are theoretically able to escape, right? Why hand over someone who's able to escape? However, if there's absolutely no chance of anyone making it, then there is an opinion that you actually do a lottery and one person is handed over. There is such an opinion.
If there is a chance.
If there is, there's an opinion which says like this. The way we always discuss this, the way we always learn it, is that if a non-Jew comes, and we're talking about the way the Talmud tells the story, says if you have an anti-Semitic person comes along and says, or anti-Semitic group, and they come and say, either you hand over one of you, or we kill, or for us to kill, or we're going to kill all of you. The law is you're not allowed to give over anyone. Right. However, there is a very strong opinion. There is an opinion which holds. It's a minority opinion which says that rule only applies if the people in town could be able to escape somehow. But if no one is able to escape whatsoever, if
the rule applies not to hand over anyone.
Yes, you can't hand over anyone because some people can potentially escape from here. And then why would I hand over someone to the anti-Semite who's definitely going to kill him if he can somehow get out over here? He can escape.
It implies that you can't hand over the one. There's no way of anyone escaping.
Right. No, if there's a way of people escaping, somehow people can escape. So then you cannot hand over, because I know that if I give it to this anti-Semite, he's definitely going to kill. But over here, people can escape and get out of it.
Right?
However, okay, there's a discussion whether people go if a person comes and volunteers. It's a complicated thing. But if there's no possibility for escape, says this opinion, this very minority opinion, that there is a difference. There's no possibility for escape. So then, well, there's no way out. We hand them out. Anyway, someone is going to get killed over here. Therefore, they say you can do a lottery and give over one person. Okay? That's a minority opinion. Now, he says like this. If there's such an opinion, listen to this thinking. He says, if there's such an opinion, when we're talking about human beings, right, who are already born, that you can hand over one to save many when there's no escape, there's such an opinion. He says, perhaps everyone would agree when you're talking about fetuses, which are definitely not like a human being, right? They're not like nothing, but they're not like a human being either, like a born human being, a lower level, exactly. He says, perhaps in such a situation, everyone would agree that since there's no escape and all of them would be born, that you can kill one to save another. That's his first thinking. And that's his first, there's a clever thinking. That's his first way of thinking why it should be allowed. And he said, based on that, it would be allowed to save other fetuses.
So
the second approach, get into it. You won't step ahead on. The second approach, we're finishing up in a couple of minutes. The second approach, he says, is by comparing pregnancy reduction to, he says, if you have people trapped under a fallen building. Okay? There's been an earthquake and there's people trapped over there. There are opinions to say that if all people will die if a tractor is not used or some heavy machinery is not used, then one may use heavy machinery and, let's say, a tractor and drive over and move the rubble, even though that you may hasten someone's death quicker by doing that, because the heavy machinery may just drive over them and kill such a person. He says similarly in our situation, he says, that since all fetuses will die, it should be permitted to kill a few prematurely to save the rest who would definitely die. That's how he compares it. There may be some who will argue, but some who will not, who would accept that reasoning, not accept it. But he says, again, you have to remember, if that is a law when you're talking about viable, living human beings, people who have already come out, so he says, perhaps we can make a kavachomer, we'll say, how much more so when you're talking about that maybe even more people would agree when you're talking about a fetus. So his conclusions are based on the assumption, he says it's allowed, but that is based on the assumption that none would survive, that none of the other fetuses would survive if this pregnancy production was not performed. Because he compares it to cases where everyone is going to die if nothing is done. But what if some may survive? If some may survive, so then his logic would not support pregnancy reduction. His logic is only if they're all going to die. So if a situation where you have seven, where there's very likely that they'll all go that they're all going to die, so there, seven, eight, whatever it is, so then that would be the case. However, there is another much more lenient opinion. And I say this, that this is more lenient because he has a general leniency with regards to abortion, that he allows abortion even for, well, he follows the school that allows abortion even for certain imperfections, obviously at a particular stage in gestation. And he says that a doctor can perform fetal reduction even if the fetuses will be born prematurely and with severe mental or physical defects, meaning not only if they would not make it at all, but even if they would make it, but would not be able to be healthy, then one would be allowed to do pregnancy reduction to ensure that a couple of the fetuses would be born in a healthy way. That's a lot more lenient. Now, just to finish off the ruling, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and this, before we get to which one you choose, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, we mentioned before, say, ruled, I mean, he was the posek, he carried huge weight, and still does, in a lot of these issues. He ruled twice, which is known on, I'm sure many others have been not written about and were private matters, on a couple of cases. One was a case of a woman who was through fertility treatment. She was carrying sex tablets. She had six inside her, and it was dangerous for dangerous for her, but also they wanted to do it in such a way. Well, dangerous for her, she could have got by with aborting two or three, but it was also dangerous for each other if there would be three in there at the same time. And he allowed to do reduction, and he said that pregnancy reduction in such a situation was allowed even after 40 days, which halakhically makes a difference in abortion. If it's the first 40 days of pregnancy or afterwards, he says even then it's allowed. Why? Because medically it's better to do it at such a stage. It gives better chances to the other fetuses, and therefore one would be allowed to do it. Another situation he had, the question he was asked was about a woman who was carrying triplets, but she had a very small pelvis, whatever it was. I wasn't able to support, wasn't able to carry them, and therefore he allowed also in order to ensure, and this wasn't dangerous to her in such a way that it was dangerous for the fetuses, and he allowed pregnancy reduction in such a situation. Now, which fetus should be chosen for abortion? And the common answer is, the answer which is given is that whichever fetus maximizes chances of success and minimizes the risks to the other fetuses, which are going to go on and make it, that is the one which usually boils down to the one which is most accessible in the operation, in the taking out. That is the one. It's almost like that lottery. It's not exactly. It's not that there's something which is chosen. It's not that they choose and they look at this one and that one. Sorry? It's a lottery. Right. What if one is defective? Can it be chosen first? So the answer really depends on if you say that you can generally perform abortion for carrying a defective fetus in general. If, as we've been following, except for that very lenient opinion, that abortion cannot be performed and this is definitely the majority opinion, just because one is carrying a defective child, then definitely that is not a criteria over here whatsoever. It doesn't count at all. The defective fetus is seen just as the other ones, because the question over here has got nothing to do with defective or not defective. The question has got to do with we want to abort a couple in order to save the others. Obviously, they point out the minimum should be aborted, and the rabbis write again, as if we didn't know, but really to make it very clear, that there's no way in the world to abort, to have pregnancy reduction, if it's just for convenience purposes. It's just because that the person decides, I'm getting more than I bargained for. Wanted to have children, but I didn't want to have three. Wanted to have, two will do, or one will do. For such a thing, definitely it's not allowed. So to conclude, just on that issue of pregnancy reduction, we did it quite quickly, but all agree that if it's a danger to the mother, then the child may be aborted. The vast majority agree, are of the opinion, that even if the danger is just to each other, then abortion may be done, and it's chosen in quite a random way, whichever is best for the situation, whichever will bring out the maximum results.
Right.
Triage, right.
And that was the first person you got to receive the treatment. So could it be that when you're going through selecting which fetus to save, the first one you get to would be the one that you would save, and so you would...
Excellent question. Fantastic question. I'm asking you, when it comes to the question of triage, let's say there's a paramedic who comes to an accident scene, there's many people lying around. So the golden rule is, in halacha, first come, first serve, because you're not allowed to pass over a mitzvah, you're not allowed to pass over someone who needs help, koach nefesh. It doesn't matter who the other people are, it's the prime minister, whoever it is, you have to take care of the first person. So asking, so the same thing over here, you got the first fetus that you encounter, that's the one maybe you should save. But really, what you're trying to do over here is do whatever will be best for the procedure, right? If you're looking at the general thing, first... Right, exactly. Well, the first one may also be the one which would be easiest to move aside. Well, sometimes the first one which they encounter, I don't know, understand how these things work, but the first one which is encountered, it's basically the one which is most accessible, which would probably, that's what would probably boil down to, the one which is most accessible for them to be able to get rid of this one in order to save others. I said that having a defective one is not a criteria over here, unless you're of the opinion that abortion can generally be done just for any defective fetus. But that's obviously only if the defect over here is not going to cause a risk to the other fetuses. Because if it's going to cause a risk, well, then obviously that's the one which should go first. But if it's some other risk, if it's some other defect, you know, something which years later, something like that, so then that's definitely not criteria at all, shouldn't be taken into account.
With all this said, is there some kind of halacha, something that you should put in, you know, a minimum number of eggs, so that you're not going to have
that's an excellent question. Rabbis talk about that, and they say it's quite difficult to rule in a particular way, because you can't say, well, take a minimum of eggs, because people, very often it doesn't work, and that's why they try to do these things. But the rabbis do caution. I did see one particular rabbi write, people have to be very, very cautious with this, because you're not allowed to do something in such a way where you're going to have to come to this. Because, you know, if it was just a single fetus, it wouldn't be allowed at all, right? So therefore, caution should be taken that not too many, not in such a way which is overdoing it. Not 15 or something which is out of the question, which you hear, you have these cases. You're not to count on the loophole. No, not to count on the loophole. But again, you don't see rabbis saying, I don't see many who say, well, you can only put in one at a time.
Yeah.
Right? I didn't see many who say that, because one at a time, they also consider the huge expenses involved. Every single time that there's failure, it doesn't, you know, what it causes emotionally and these kind of things.
You're starting off with fertility problems, like
right.
Killer,
right.
When you're doing